Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
In his 20s as a currency trader, my next guest became a multimillionaire. He actually became Citibank's most successful trader in the world at one point, but he did it by betting on economic disaster, on the poor getting poorer. So he burnt out then, walked away from banking, and now I suppose he fights to change the system that he used to work in. Author and economist Gary Stevenson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brendan.
Gary, will we go back first? Your background, you weren't a typical high finance City of London trader. Tell me a bit about your background and where you came from.
So I come from a place called Ilford, which is a kind of East London, Essex contested territory. It's a bit of an armpit of London, some might say. You know, small little terraced house on a street full of small little terraced houses, railway going through the back garden, sleeping in a bunk bed, kids playing in the street, this kind of thing. But of course, being in East London, we had the skyscrapers of Canary Wharf, big financial centre, go up when I was about 7 or 8. So I was always very talented at maths. I saw these skyscrapers going up and I thought, probably like a lot of kids, I'll grow up and I'll work in there one day.
Yeah. Now, and class kind of permeates the book. You've written a book, The Trading Game of Confession. So you were good at maths. You ended up at the prestigious London School of Economics, which people will have heard of. I was struck by how you arrived there and you're brilliant at maths and you're well able for everything, but everybody else knows the rules of the game and you don't, isn't it?
Yeah, so this is the thing. People who've been to these like very elite universities will recognise this story, which is, you know, you're kind of told when you're a kid, work hard, you know, study hard, do your exams, get good grades and you'll get a good job. And I sort of naively believed that. And I got good grades and I was able to go to the London School of Economics, as you say. And I was doing very well there. And I came back for my second year. I was studying maths and economics. And then suddenly everything changed. People start wearing suits to the lectures and people start talking in these. Everything they say is a three-letter acronym, CDS, MBA, MBS, you know, CDOs, M&A. And you're just like, what on earth has happened, basically? And what you find is suddenly, second year, so you haven't even got your grades yet, everyone is internship year. And everyone's applying for these internships. And the way that you get a job, what it was back then, is you basically apply for 30 banks, CV and cover letter. And I look around and all these guys around me, you know, one guy was president of the Junior United Nations in his high school, you know, another guy is, you know, played the oboe at the Royal Albert Hall, and other guys got a charity that drives dirt bikes through the Sahara Desert for some reason. And I was fluffing pillows at a sofa shop in Beckton, East London, next to a sewage works. You know what I mean? And you suddenly realize, really, it doesn't matter what my grades are. There's no way that I'm going to get this job, basically.
Yeah. You observe when you're in the LSE, a very simple observation. A lot of rich people expect poor people to be stupid.
Yeah, this was, my good friend Sagamalde, one of the few people who's permissioned his real name for the book, is this guy, is really lovely guy, Kenyan Indian guy, who his dad like runs the entire East African soap industry. And after my first year, I got quite good grades. And I come back in second year and suddenly people sort of know who I am, which confused me because I had good grades first year, but not like the best grades. And I speak to my friend Sagamalde. Why does everybody suddenly know who I am? And he says to me, well, it's because you got such good grades. And so Saga's grades are better than mine. I said to him, well, you know, but your grades are better than mine. And he says to me, well, yeah, of course. But nobody expected that from you. And that was the first sort of time when I realized that, I mean, this is the thing. It's true. You go to elite spaces. There's not a lot of people that speak like me in those spaces. And those rich people think that we're not there because we're not that smart in their mind. So I decided I'd try and prove them wrong.
Yeah, yeah. So you this probably tells us everything we need to know about trading, right? You got a job in the city by essentially winning a card game. I suppose people will remember the Liar's Poker, the Michael Lewis thing.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
Tell us about that.
So the book is called The Trading Game, and that trading game is based on the name of this card game. So I was sort of quite frustrated at uni thinking, how the hell am I going to get this job? And I was trying to sort of make myself well known for being good at maths and economics. And this kid from Grimsby comes up to me one day. I never met him before in my life. He just says, you Gary Stevenson? Oh, yeah. He goes, listen, Citibank hire one trader a year through a card game, which is basically like a maths game. And I was like, you know, thank God, here's the way in, but I don't have to play the oboe, you know what I mean? And so I was like, it's a game. Card game, I like games, like maths, let's go. And this kid sort of taught me the rules of this game. It's basically a betting game, poker-style game. It is similar to Liar's Poker from the book Liar's Poker. And I go into this competition with a bunch of, you know, kids of foreign billionaires, which is most of what LSE is. And I cleaned up and I won the game, and that's how I got my job in the city.
Yeah. So now, you paint this amazing picture of the of life on the trading floor and of the kind of guys there and everything. I suppose, like, look, all the stereotypes, we've all seen the movies, Wall Street, American Psycho, all of that. It's kind of all true, is it?
Well, yes and no. I think these movies tend to glamorize it a little bit. I wanted to show you the real story, which is I worked with a bunch of nutters. Anyone who reads the book will see this. There was one guy who got in trouble for getting me drunk one night and responded by barking at me like a wolf on the desk and gnashing his teeth at me. So there was these kind of guys there. But I get frustrated by these movies because I think they show a kind of glamorous image that's a bit too sexy. I watched this recent show, Industry, and there was so much sex in it. I was a trader for 7 years. I never once worked with a woman. You know, this is a place of really kind of often slightly socially maladjusted kind of geeky maths boys. So I wanted to really show you what they are, and I wanted to make these characters real, get under the skin, show you a little bit of their emotion and of course my emotion as well. I would like to add, these guys are not all terrible people. I really wanted to show you, look, listen, there are some guys in there who are not the nicest, and there are people here there that do bad things. But listen, just like in any office, I'm sure you see this in your line of work, there's good people, there's bad people. I want you to be there with me, 21-year-old Gary, walking onto the trading floor and meeting these guys as they really are.
Yeah, no, the thing is, you fit in and you kind of started flourishing there, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, this is kind of, you know, I come from quite a poor background, and obviously trading floors nowadays are really quite elite spaces, very wealthy people, normally from very wealthy backgrounds. But, you know, I don't think I've ever been as kind of welcomed and accepted into a space, maybe not completely my class background.
Yeah.
But welcome as I was on the trading floor. And the reason for that is these guys kind of recognized very quickly, this kid's good and he's going to make us money. And it didn't really matter. You know, I was going in there, you know, looking like I was wearing, you know, a suit that I bought from Next, and all these guys are wearing like $3,000 suits. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter because at the end of it, one thing I love about trading floors and one thing I miss about trading floors, it doesn't matter who you are. You could be the most famous guy in the world. We come in, you've got a disagreement with me, we put our money on the table and we settle it there. And, you know, my bets were winning and they loved it.
So it's an honest space then, yeah?
In some ways, yeah. I mean, not everybody is honest. If you read the book all the way through, you'll see there's some...
No, I have done,
there is quite a bit of bad behaviour in there. But I mean, you know, nowadays, what I do nowadays, you probably know, I've got a YouTube channel, I talk in the media about our economic crisis. And I wrote an article in The Guardian, like June 2020, saying when lockdown ends, we're going to have a massive economic crisis. House prices will go up. Inequality will go through the roof. Stock prices will go through the roof. Inflation, living standards will collapse. You know, it's exactly what happened. And this is the exact kind of thing I used to do on the trading floor that made me very famous and very successful. Whereas you do this in the media, you come out and say, guys, economy's going to collapse. 3 years later, nobody remembers. So it is frustrating. There is an honesty there.
Yeah.
A recognition that we should check the homework and we should see who's getting it right and who's getting it wrong.
Yeah. And if you're right, it's proven. I think as time went on, though, and I presume this happens a lot of the guys, that like it kind of became more than a job for you, didn't it? It becomes this all consuming lifestyle. Was it almost an addiction?
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about that. A big part of this story is about mental health, about men's mental health, about addiction, obsession. I mean, when we talk about addiction, you know, classically you think about things like alcohol and drugs, and these things are associated with the city. But, you know, you've read the book, you'll see I wasn't really drinking, I wasn't taking drugs in the city. But for me, it was the numbers, it was the money, it was the game, it was the competition. I wanted to be the best trader, and it became all consuming for me. And I think what I want to get through with this book is kind of a message. It's about money and obsession with money, and it's about what that did to me as an individual, what it did to the people around me, the industry I was working in, but also what it does to society. Because, you know, I look around the situation we're in now, I've got a YouTube that says, listen guys, we need to do something about inequality or living standards will keep collapsing. And I get 100 messages a day saying, Gary, teach me how to make money. So, you know, for me, the story here is about what happened to me, what it did to me, my obsession with money, but, you know, what it does to you and what it does to the readers and what it is doing to our society. That's the bigger picture. You know,
We'll come to the societal stuff and everything, but I think the story is illustrative in itself. So if we just go through a little bit more of it first.
Sure.
You talk about that the obsession with money and everything, but the weird thing is like you weren't even enjoying it on any level. So say for example, you're 23, right? You got your first big bonus, didn't you? And it was like 400 grand sterling, right?
Yeah.
You found that very hard to deal with, though.
So, you know, this is like kind of the first big turning point of the book, because I had been kind of misled by one of my managers to believe that if I achieved this, I said, I want to make 100 grand. And he goes, it's impossible. And I said, tell me what to do. And he said, you want to make 100 grand for the bank, you got to make $10 million for Citibank. And kind of the kid I was like, all right, done. Back to the desk. What do I do to make 10 million quid? Head down. Rest of the year, 9 months, bang, and I made my $12 million for the bank. And I was expecting 120 grand, right? $10 million, 100 grand, $12 million, 120 grand.
Okay.
Then I go into this office and I get given this 400 grand. And it was, I was 23, just turned 23. You know, I come from a very poor background. You know, £400,000 was just an inconceivably large amount of money for me. And I think if I made the 100 grand, I would have sort of gone home, taken the lads out, bought something for my mum. But 400 grand, it felt like criminal. And the next thing I remember, I was sitting on the desk with this guy who in the book is called Billy, my sort of scouse trading idol. And I felt like I was going to start crying. And it's crazy. And he just goes, listen, mate, go outside, have a sit down. And I go outside and I sit down. And the first thing I remembered was my dad. And my dad worked for Royal Mail for 35 years. And when I was a kid, he used to get up super early. My mum used to wake me up so I could see him. The train used to go past my house and we'd try and wave at him as he went in. He went in super early, come back super late, you know, my whole life for what, 20 grand a year. And then you've walked in and you basically played the computer game for a year and you've made 400 grand.
Yeah.
And you think, you know, I thought about the kids I went to school with and I thought about their parents, their mums and their dads and how hard they worked. And you know, people listening to this show right now will be working super hard for 20, 30 grand, you know? And I was too young, I think, to really sort of internalize everything about it, but it felt wrong. But then at the same time, you've got this other voice in the back of your head saying, well, if you can make 400 grand, what did that guy over there make? What did these guys make? What did those posh boys over there in the pink shirts make? You're better than them. You can make £1 million. You can make £2 million. So it's this kind of this strong emotional reaction, which is the one side part of you, this human part of you, kind of knows on level that it's wrong. But on the other side, you want more.
Yeah, yeah. And then part of you is also, you, as you're saying there, you've realised that actually my dad's a mug. It's a mug's game and the dice are loaded against people like me and everything. And then I guess part of that is you kind of weren't able to enjoy the money. Like it cut you off from your family and the people around you in a way, didn't it?
Yeah, there's this mad... So when I made actually my earlier bonus, which was only 13 grand, the guys in the desk, who are all you know, rich backgrounds, they're like, you got to buy something for your dad. You got to buy something for your dad. And listen, I come from quite a poor background and it's not the kind of family where you just buy people stuff. You know what I mean? And I didn't know. I didn't know what you buy. And then they were like, what does your dad like? And I was like, well, he likes football. They're like, why don't you get your dad a Sky Sports subscription? And we never had Sky Sports. We never got with Sky Sports. We couldn't watch the football, right? And so I bought it for my dad. And then suddenly, you know, Saturday morning, I wake up and my dad's watching the football. And before I used to work at Citibank, me and my dad used to go to the local football team, Leyton Orient in East London, and watch every game. But then I was working in the city and I was too busy and I was too tired to go with him. So instead, I've taken this money and I bought him Sky Sports. And just something about that just really symbolized this money taking me away from my family and my friends and the things that really mattered. And I think this is the big problem with a very unequal society when we're heading into more unequal societies is it forces you as an individual to choose between poverty and separation from society.
Okay, go on, explain that.
Well, listen, if you have a very unequal society, then there's a few people who are rich and live good lives, and everybody else is poor. And you have to be in one of these camps. You know what I mean? And I grew up poor. The only way for me to not, you know, not suffer the poverty and not have my kids suffer the poverty I suffered is to change camps and move into this tiny sort of minority elite where suddenly I'm living a completely different life to my friends and my family. And I think when I was
a kid... And then you can't look your dad in the eye then?
It's not so much I can't look my dad in the eye, but like, he's not in my world anymore. And my, you know, as much as you can, you know, I grew up in London and, you know, in a very sort of immigrant part of London where we're all like, we want to make money, we want to move up. And you think if you make money for you, it's going to be fine. But then you make money for you and you realize, well, what about my mate? What about Aiden? What about him? What about he can't pay the mortgage? You know what I mean? He can't afford to have a family. And then you start realizing, no matter how much you make for yourself, you can't separate yourself from this world, you know. And I think the big difference between me and the guys that I work with is, you know, they come from rich families. They went to elite schools. They went to elite universities. And they can tell themselves, you know, the reason that the poor are poor is because they're lazy or they're stupid. They don't work hard or, you know, they're taking drugs or whatever. But I grew up with those people and I know that they're hardworking, good, smart people that are struggling to pay the bills. And even making it for myself, it doesn't change that, you know, it doesn't save the people around you.
That kind of leads us as well to like how you made all the money for Citibank and for yourself. Your big bet, your kind of key insight was that the people around you, the people you knew, had no money, wasn't it?
Yeah, so this is the big thing. So I made that my first big bonus in beginning of 2010. And then in 2010, I had my first like big loss. I lost $8 million in a week for the bank, which is massive. And I was still 23 and I was quite traumatized. And I started bringing my textbooks into the office to try and like figure it out. And I was very lucky to have worked with this one Scouse trader from Liverpool, never went to university, absolute trading genius. And he saw me reading these books and he let me do it a couple of days. Third day, I'm reading this book on the desk, slaps the book right out of my hand into the bin, sticks his head right into my face. What are you doing? Does this look like Jack and Ori to you, mate? You're not a kid anymore. You're not going to find the answer to the economy in a bunch of textbooks, mate. If you want to know what's going on in the economy, go home and ask your mum what's happening in her financial life. Walk down the high street. Look at what shops are opening down, closing up. Look at the advertisements on the tube. Ask your friends. Ask your friends' mums. And I describe that in the book as the most important thing I ever heard. And this is when I realized that, you know, if you want to understand the economy, you need to understand ordinary people's lives. And the truth is, most economists, most traders, from very rich backgrounds, they don't know what's going on. So I went and I asked people, you know, what's going on with you? And this is beginning of 2011. And even though in the city, people making a ton of money, ordinary people never really recovered from that crisis. They couldn't. What I saw when I looked around me, I was in my early 20s then. I saw a generation of my friends whose parents owned property and they themselves would never be able to own property. And then immediately after that, 2011, we had the sovereign debt crisis, which of course Ireland was involved in, but also Spain, Portugal, Italy, Greece, you know, even the UK, the US, what we saw is governments going further into debt, losing their assets. And I was kind of like rolling this around in my head for a bit. How can my friends be losing their assets and also governments be losing their assets? Like, where are all the assets going? Obviously, I didn't have to look far. I'm sitting on a trading floor surrounded by millionaires and I suddenly realized it's us. You know, we are the balance and it's not going to stop, right? Because if my friends can't afford to pay their bills when they own their own house, what happens when they can't own their own house? If my government can't run a balanced budget when it's not massively in debt, what happens when it is in debt? And then you realize this keeps going. This gets worse and worse. This compounds and the inequality will get worse and worse and the economy will never get better. And of course, I knew what to do. I had to put the bet on. And that was my bet, that the economy would never recover. And that was the bet that made me, in 2011, Citibank's top trader, and they said, well done, mate. Here's $2 million. Do it again.
So, Gary, am I simplifying this completely if I say that one of the kind of key things here in the way the game is rigged is it that whoever owns assets keeps winning, because in the upturn, they go up. And then in the downturn, as we kind of saw in recent years and during COVID and everything else, governments pump money into economies, but that money ends up going inflating assets as well. So basically, the people who have wealth, They keep winning, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, there's this great conversation between me and my Australian colleague, JB, who comes from an ordinary background, but is very rich in his sort of mid-40s by the time I work with him. And after 2008, when the economy was really weak, everyone was like, stocks will go down, right? Stocks will go down, property will go down. I don't know if you remember, there was an article in the when I was writing for The Guardian, during COVID, everyone was like, house prices are going to collapse, right? Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at what happens in the long run after 2008 and the same after COVID, these enormous amounts of money get poured into the economy. And that's partly government deficits, and that's partly monetary policy from central banks, low interest rates, quantitative easing. That money all ends up being held by rich people. And what the rich people do, if you give them a ton of money, they buy assets. So you end up in this situation where, exactly as you say, strong economy, asset prices go up, stock prices, house prices. But weak economy, you might get a little dip in the short term, but in the long run, asset prices go up even more. I mean, you know, the story of after 2008, which is the period the book is largely set in, is, you know, continual prolonged falls in living standards and record all-time increases in house prices and stock prices. And here we are, 10 years later, after COVID, seeing exactly the same thing happening again.
Okay, and we'll come back to that a bit. Yeah. But in terms of, if we go back to your story, happened to you then? You got, like, burned out, depressed, kind of physically ill?
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, basically, I started to get these, like, pains in my heart, like, sort of stomach pains and heart pains. And, you know, looking back now, I can see I was falling into a depression. But, you know, at the time, I didn't really know what it was. It was kind of like a crisis of meaning, in a sense. I was working so hard to get this bonus. And I get paid this one massive bonus. And, you know, I go home, I'm sitting in the corner of my front room, like, doing all my investments. And my girlfriend at the time comes over and she's like, you know, is it all right? Did you get what you wanted? And I was like, yeah, I got what I wanted. And she's like, well, why do you seem so stressed out then? And I was like, well, it's a lot of money. I've got to invest all this money. And she says to me, you know, if I had just made as much money as you'd made, the last thing I'd be doing is sitting in the corner of my front room stressing out. And of course, I realize, once again, one part of me realizes, of course, you're obviously right. But the other part of me is like, no, this is important. This matters, you know. And I think you kind of get this split in me. And I think, in a sense, it's a sort of a battle between me and myself, in a way. Like, what are you going to do? Which way are you going to turn? Because, you know, one of the big themes of the book is, you know, these trading floors full of very, very wealthy men, you know, multi-millionaires. Often they're very unhappy. Very often they never see their families. Why are they there? And why does nobody ever leave? And this is, then we move into this period where I'm sort of asking myself my question, like, what am I going to do? Am I going to try and do something about this collapsing economy? Can you do anything? Am I going to walk away from this £2 million a year job? You know, and basically I fell into quite a deep depression, which is, you know, it's all in the book. You can see it in there.
Mm-hmm. So you got out eventually. It's not easy to get out either, but you got out at 27. Now, it's interesting, and this goes back to what your mate Billy told you earlier about, like, go out and ask your friends what's going on with them. So you kind of dabbled with studying economics in academia, say, but you don't really rate economists, do you? Academic economists.
Yeah, I come out in 2014 and I've kind of got this vague idea, like, by this point, I've already made millions of pounds betting the economy will collapse forever. You know, and I'm convinced at that point, and still now, the economy will keep collapsing. And you're kind of like, well, what do you do? What do you do? And you sort of bounce around. And I made a website explaining it, but obviously nobody knows who I am, so nobody's reading my website. And, you know, I did what you're kind of supposed to do, which is I went back to university. And I did a two-year economics master's at Oxford, obviously very prestigious university. And, you know, it's a bunch of very wealthy people in capes and bow ties in castles telling you everything's fine, you know. And I went into my mid-year review and I was like, listen, this course is terrible. And they were like, why? And I said, you know, why don't you talk about what's happening to ordinary people? Why don't you talk about, you know, the house price crisis? And they go to me, you know, housing crisis only in London. And I said, well, that's where all the jobs are. And this economics professor at Oxford says to me, that's not true, I've got a job. As if some guy in Wigan is going to go and become econ professor at Oxford University, you know. And, you know, I said, that's nonsense, mate. You're not talking about what's happening. People's lives are getting worse and worse. And, you know, these guys, three guys in bow ties and capes in a wood-paneled hall, say to me, no, that's not true. The economy's getting better. And you can't help but hear these two missing words, right? The economy is getting better for us. Because the way I see it, in my opinion, this is a crisis of inequality, and it has been, you know, in the whole period I write about in the book. And the problem with economic crises of inequality is they look great from the top. And how many people have a voice in a debate about economics who are not at the top? So you end up in a situation where a bunch of rich people all shake each other's hands, say, well done, mate, things are great, stock prices at all-time highs, and ordinary people out there working ordinary jobs can't afford to have a house and a family. You know, it was very frustrating.
Okay, so you've taken it directly to the people now. You mentioned the YouTube channel, Gary's Economics.
Yes.
Do you still think we're heading for disaster?
Yes. I mean, if you look in the last 3 or 4 years, inequality has increased massively. You know, governments gave enormous amounts of money out during COVID, enormous government deficits during COVID. And I'm not opposed to that at all. You know, I'm not opposed to lockdowns. These things were necessary. But nobody asks the question of who accumulates the money. Now, I don't know the numbers for Ireland, but here in the UK, the UK government deficit since COVID is £800 billion, which is £16,000 for every UK adult. Now, if you know the government's going to give up this enormous amount of money, you have to be asking who's going to accumulate the money. And I asked the question at the beginning of COVID, and I could see from the beginning it's going to be accumulated by the rich, which is why I knew inequality would increase massively, house prices and stock prices would increase massively, inflation would increase, and living standards would decrease. But, you know, nobody's talking. We here in the UK, and I'm sure you've got a similar conversation in Ireland, we talk about this massively increased government debt as if that money's just disappeared and now we have to basically set the welfare state on fire. Listen, who has that money now? We've seen the biggest and fastest ever increase in the wealth of the richest, in the wealth of millionaires and billionaires. And now to pay for it, we're basically shutting the welfare state down. Listen, if you don't deal with inequality, you're going to see living standards collapse. You can't let this get out of control. And unfortunately, nobody's talking about it, which is why I'm on here now, which is why I wrote this book, because I want to get this issue, rapidly increasing inequality, into the conversation. Because I think if we don't fix it, we will continue to see really significant falls in living standards. And you can see what's happened in the last few years. We're talking about families who can't afford to simultaneously feed their kids and turn the heating on. And that will get worse if we don't take action, Brendan.
Okay. Point well made. And I'm now going to be like the people who get on to you when they watch your diatribes on inequality and say, do you still trade?
I still trade, mate.
Yeah.
I still trade. Listen, I'm a trader. Listen, if I wasn't a good trader, I wouldn't be on this show right now, Brendan. Yeah. That's how I made all my money. Listen, trading is how I know that I am not mad. Listen, there are a lot of people out there in the world that will tell you that the world's about to end, that society's going to collapse. The Jehovah's Witnesses have been doing it for 100 years, right? Not many of them can go out there and beat the markets year after year and make correct economic predictions year after year. I can do that. That is why I got paid millions of pounds a year to be a trader. Nobody else can do that, Brendan, but I can do that. So I'm going to keep doing it because that is what gives me a voice. That is my power. That is what I'm good at. And that is my skill, which I can use to protect my people, mate, because it's people like me, like my family, who are struggling to feed the kids out here. So, mate, I'm going to keep doing it and I'm going to keep coming on shows like this, making videos on the YouTube. God willing, I'll write another book, mate, to get this message out there. And, you know, I use what I can, Brendan. I use what I can.
And listen, I won't demean us both by asking you for investment tips, but I'm thinking if we go back to what you're saying about assets, so gold at record highs, I think this week, stocks, all record the indices, highs, record highs, most assets, property, everything record highs. Are you betting that assets are going to keep going up?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I've been betting it for a long time. So obviously I've made a lot of money in these last couple of months when everything's gone up. Listen, the big thing which nobody's talking about, I talk a lot in the book about being a good trader. It's not about being right. It's about understanding the specific ways in which other people are wrong. Because if everybody knows something, there's no money in it. You need to know what is missing. The big thing which is missing in the economic conversation now is we talk about the government deficit. Nobody talks about where that money ended up. The government deficit in the last 5 years is so unbelievably huge. Nothing else matters. Nothing else matters. So we talk about the government deficit. At the same time, that money given out by the government has been accumulated by rich people. It's enormous, unbelievably huge amounts of money. So you have to accept that the economy now is different from 5 years ago because now rich people are all sitting on unbelievably enormous piles of cash. It's actually very difficult for rich people to get rid of their cash because they don't like to spend enormous amounts of money. They have enormous amounts of passive income. The main thing they do is buy assets. But who owns the assets? are the rich people. So all they do is buy assets from each other. They will buy some assets from the middle class. They'll buy assets from government. I think you'll see big decreases in government wealth. But, you know, this will push prices up. And I think the next thing we're going to see in the next sort of few months, we'll see inflation start to fall.
Yeah.
We'll see interest rates start to come down. At the moment, these rich guys are sitting on, you know, making 4 or 5% on their cash. Once those interest rates start to fall, they're going to start buying real assets.
Back into assets, looking for yield.
You know, and okay. Listen, of course, it will be volatile up and down. And right here at this moment, you know, we've had a massive increase in the last couple of months. So you probably expect to see a little bit of a bounce down again. But look, in the long run, people have not accepted and recognized how much richer the rich are than they were 4 years ago. And if the rich are going to be much, 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 much richer, that needs higher asset prices because rich people buy assets.
Gary Stevenson, that's an amazing conversation. You're a terrific communicator. That was brilliant. And people just texting in. Very simple text here. This guy's amazing. And Gary is brilliant at making Galway. That guy, Gary, he's brilliant. Trader with a conscience. How refreshing. And on and on. The book is called The Trading Game by Gary Stevenson. It's terrific. It's published by Alan Lane. And Gary will be in conversation with Marina Devlin in DLR Lexicon in Dunleary on the 19th of March. Tickets are available through eventbrite.ie. Gary Stevenson, thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, mate. Thank you very much.
Email brendan@rte.ie.